persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are advised to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated.
The court has three causes on its oral submission docket today. In the order in which they're argued, they are Clayton W. Williams and Otis E. Graham versus David and Rosalinda Ovio from LaSalle County, the Science Spectrum Incorporated versus Arthur Martinez and others from Lovett County, and Grain Dealers Mutual Insurance Company versus Gerald Wayne McKee, and Diana Michelle McKee, individually his next friend of Kelly McKee from Bear County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a copy of the arguments with the clerk of our court if you so desire. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of the first two arguments and then take a long recess and resume at 2 o'clock for the final argument. The court is ready to hear from petitioner in Williams versus Olivo.
May it please the court, Mr. Huddleston and Mr. Stolle, the arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Huddleston will open with the first 10 minutes. Mr. Huddleston will also present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Alex Huddleston. I'm here on behalf of petitioner Clayton W. Williams, Jr., Inc. this morning. Mr. Scott Stolle represents the other petitioner. I will address the issue of duty in my presentation, plus whatever other matters the court may wish to hear from me about. Mr. Stolle intends to focus his argument on the individual liability of Otis Graham. This is a premises liability case involving an oil field accident. David Olivo, the plaintiff in the trial court, was an employee of Diamond M, a drilling contractor, which sued Clayton W. Williams, Jr., Inc., which was the operator of oil lease, and Graham, who was a drilling consultant who had been retained by Williams. Olivo's employer, Diamond M, was an independent contractor retained by Williams, and Olivo was injured when he fell from a pipe rack and landed, striking his back on a drill pipe thread protector, which is a cap which screws onto the end of a joint drill pipe to protect the threads. The thread protector was placed, was a part of the Diamond M drilling equipment brought to the premises by Diamond M and was used in drilling the well. It was placed in the area where Mr. Olivo fell upon it by employees, unknown employees of the Diamond M drilling crew. So it is our contention that Olivo is complaining about a premises condition that was created after his employer, Diamond M, entered the premises, and it was created by his employer. The central issue on this appeal, we believe, is whether or not Williams and Graham owe any legal duty to Olivo. In order to address this issue, I think we must first determine whether there was a supervisory right of control retained under the Redinger cases and those cases which follow Redinger. Because Olivo was an employee of Diamond M, an independent contractor, Williams owed Olivo no duty unless a supervisory right of control of the manner in which Diamond M did its work created a dangerous condition or unless the supervisory right of control was retained over an activity of Diamond M which caused Olivo to be injured.
Why don't you lose under the Tovar decision?
Tovar, I think, is easily distinguished, Your Honor. In the Tovar case, for one thing, it was a very short per curiam opinion. We do not have the entire contractual provision presented that was at issue in Tovar. And it's our contention that we begin the analysis with an examination of whether there was a contractual right of control retained. We know that there's three or four words in the Tovar opinion which match up to paragraph 6.1 of the drilling contract, which is at issue in this case, but we do not have the full presentation and can't tell whether that contractual provision matches 6.1. Nevertheless, in the Tovar case, the operator's representative had actual knowledge of the improper design of a blowout preventer. The operator's representative on the lease, with knowledge of this faulty design, had even advised his superiors that he believed the well should be shut down. In our case, there's absolutely no evidence that Otis Graham had any knowledge whatsoever of the placement or the location of the thread protector, which Mr. Olivo fell on. And our contract, I think, makes it clear that 6.1 is a default provision. It is a provision under which the operator must give notice to the drilling contractor of some problem, and then the contractor has the right to cure. In the absence of cure, then there are further remedies that the operator has. Furthermore, in the Tovar case, we were dealing with a blowout, or the threat of a blowout. Paragraph 6.1 specifically provides that in the event of a blowout or imminent danger to the well itself, the operator may immediately step in and take over the well. So, for these reasons, we believe that this case is easily distinguished. There's also cases that have referred to Tovar have referred to it as a negligent activity case. In our case, we believe, is clearly a premises condition case. Continuing with the issue of the right of control, we believe that there was, in this instance, no retention of supervisory right of control. As I mentioned in responding to Justice Cornyn, we believe that the retention of control must first be determined by an examination of the contract. Defendant's Exhibit 8 is the drilling contract between Williams and Diamond M. Paragraph 14.1 of the contract explicitly provides for an independent contractor relationship between Williams and Diamond M. This was a day work contract. Much is made in the trial court statement of facts about the fact that this was a day work contract. Paragraph 3.2, which examines the day work contract, or describes the day work contract provision, explicitly makes that provision subject to the paragraph 14.1, subject to the independent contractor provision. Paragraph 6, to which I alluded earlier, gives the operator a limited right to order the work stopped if the operator becomes dissatisfied with the contractor's work. It's a general right to order the work stopped. It doesn't automatically create any liability under Redinger or Restatement Section 414, such as has been suggested by the opposing counsel in reliance on Tovar. In order to make this contract make any sense, we must give effect to both paragraph 6.1 and paragraph 14. And paragraph 14 gives the contractor control over the details of the work. Previously mentioned, paragraph 6.1 is a default provision. It's for the benefit of the operator, and it's to enable the operator to protect its investment in the well. Paragraph 6.1 does give an opportunity to cure, and therefore there's no absolute right to control the contractor's activity. Only if the well is in jeopardy, if the well itself is in jeopardy, can the operator invoke the provisions of paragraph 6.1 and immediately take over the well.
The operator could not terminate the Diamond M's drilling if the work site became unreasonably dangerous for some reason?
No, I believe that paragraph 6.1 is explicit in that it says, there's a sentence that begins after describing the right to take possession of the well or discontinue drilling, it says, however, if at the time of such notice, which would be the notice of default, there should be danger of a blowout or other well hazard to the eminent, operators shall have the right to immediately take over the operations and discontinue, abandon, or continue drilling as above provided. So it may collaterally have the effect of protecting people on the well site from a dangerous condition, but the intent of the provision is to safeguard the well itself. If there is no contractual right of control retaining the contract, then the other possibility would be whether there was an exercise control which operated to change the relationship of the parties. Our position here is that the evidence in this case established that the control relationship that was created in the contract was never altered. And there was certainly no evidence that the parties of the contract in any manner ever changed their agreement, or that Williams exercised any control or Graham exercised any control over the handling of threat protectors. In concluding, I'd like to point out to the court that we contend this is nothing more than a premises condition case.
On that, let me ask you one quick question.
Yes.
Do you think that perhaps there are really three different categories? You talked about a premises case, you talked about an activity case, and would you classify 414 as a separate type of premises liability here?
No, I don't consider it to be a separate type of premises liability. I think the issue of control determines whether or not the independent contractor relationship precludes Williams from being liable under a premises liability theory or anything else, any other type of a tort theory. So it simply, by retaining the right of control, it would enable the contractor or the, in this case, Williams, to potentially become liable for its own negligence if it retains control over the specific activity that was at issue. So to answer the question, I do not believe that Section 414 is a separate type of liability. I think it's just a means by which one can be held liable for under some other negligence theory. In this case, though, it is our position that this was a premises liability case, and therefore all of the Corbin elements must be established once the right of control has been proved. But because there was no proof of control, and because there was no proof of the Corbin elements, and most importantly, knowledge on the part of Williams and Graham, there was no duty owed to Mr. Levo.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Stolle representing Mr. Graham. I'd like to focus on the question of Mr. Graham's individual liability. Last Friday, this court decided Leach versus Hornsby. That case governs in this situation and I think dictates a holding that Mr. Graham owed no individual duty to Mr. Olivo. Like the plaintiff...
Mr. Stolle,
yes, Your Honor.
By that, are you conceding that Mr. Graham is a employee of Williams and not an independent consultant?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. The jury found that Mr. Graham was an employee and that further he was engaged in a managerial capacity. We have not challenged that finding. In fact, we accept that finding.
Are you saying then that if Mr. Graham committed an act that could be considered to be negligence, that would be attributed to Williams?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. In this situation, I am, because I think the test should be whether the duty is one that's owed to the general public in the absence of any employment relationship. In other words, if Mr. Graham had not been employed at this well site, would he have owed a duty to provide a safe workplace to Mr. Olivo? And the answer in that instance would be no.
All right, well, let me go to the next question related to that. Do you disagree with this perhaps paraphrase of what I think was said in the plaintiff's brief, and that is a Williams representative testified that Graham was responsible for safety on the rig. He had a right to tell Diamond M to pick up thread protectors, and the act of leaving thread protectors lying around constituted the carelessness and inattention, which under the paragraph 6.1 of the contract should be brought to Diamond M's attention and remedy.
No, I do not agree with that characterization, Your Honor. The question asked of Mr. Brose, the witness that you're referring to, was would leaving the thread protectors be something that would fall under paragraph 6? And the response was, well, I guess in a general sense, yes. It's the kind of thing that anyone representing the company like Mr. Graham would take to the tool pusher and suggest that the problem be fixed. So the witness couched his answer in terms of a suggestion, which is entirely consistent with the Redinger type theory, which says if it's something that the contractor can merely suggest, or the owner can merely suggest to the contractor, it doesn't mean that there's a right of control. It does not establish a right of control. Mr. Olivo complains that his workplace was not safe. In Leach, this court said that the law charges the employer with the duty to make the workplace safe, not other employees of that employer. There's only one factual distinction between the Leach case and this case. In Leach, the plaintiff worked for the company that he was suing. In other words, he was suing his own employer. In this case, Mr. Olivo is suing not his own employer, who is Diamond M. He's suing Williams, a company that he says owes him a Section 414 duty, the same duty that his employer owes him. So even though he's suing a different company, he's suing a company that he says owes him the same duty, which is the duty to provide a safe workplace. Solely assuming for the sake of argument that he's correct, this court held in Leach, if that duty is non-delegable and does not pass down to employees of the company that owes that duty, there are certainly good...
One quick question. That is, it's your position, if I understand it correctly, that regardless of all these duties, control, all that kind of stuff, that the defendants in this case could not have been the actions of the defense in this case could not have been the proximate cause of the plaintiff's injury, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Would you respond to their argument, as I understand it, that he would not have been injured nearly as bad, perhaps not at all, had those, what are they called, cones or whatever?
Correct.
Yeah, had they not been, let's say, negligently left on the ground?
Well, my position is not that our conduct, well, it's a distinction between what caused the fall and what caused the injury.
Right, I understand. And
I don't take the position that the causation only goes to what caused the fall. I agree that it goes to what caused the injury as well. My position is that we didn't cause the injury because we didn't cause the thread protector to be there, had no duty to see how thread protectors were used by this independent contractor.
If your act and omission did not cause the fall, should that eliminate the proximate cause element?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
If the court is reviewing the argument from respondent.
May I please support? My name is Carlos Villarreal, and I'm here for David Olivo and his wife, Beth Rosalinda. I, first of all, I want to thank the court for the opportunity to speak in front of you, albeit as a respondent. I appreciate the opportunity. Let's begin, and I think Justice Abbott put his finger on trying to identify what the duties are here. Is this just a premises condition case, as the petitioners would contend, or do we have also a characterization of 414 activity liability or 414 failure to provide a safe workplace liability? And I think we can visualize it by first appreciating when David Olivo entered the premises, when he entered Clayton Williams' well, there's no question he was an invitee. He was a business invitee. He came onto the premises with the knowledge of Clayton Williams and for the mutual benefit of the parties. So at that juncture in time, a duty was owed by Clayton Williams under 343 of the restatement, as interpreted by this court in the courtroom, which is Safeway, and that duty has to do with providing reasonable care as to known hazards that are unreasonably dangerous and as to those on which he has constructive knowledge. And that's a very pigeonholed or stringently defined duty under premises liability. We have the structure, trespasser, invitee, licensee, and those instructions this court has said are required persistent to that liability. There's no question about that. And they would have this court hold that that is the exclusive duty owed in this case. The problem with that characterization is that that's not the only relationship between David Olivo and Clayton Williams. There is an additional relationship here. And that relationship is described in Section 414 of the Restatement insofar as Clayton Williams retained control over the activities of Diamond M. And there is an abundance of evidence of that control. Much more evidence in this case than there have been in subsequent cases decided by this court, including so far that Justice Cornyn mentioned. And I think it's important to just get right at the distinguishing features that Mr. Huddleston identified with regard to Tovar. He says, well, they knew about the defective design of the blowout preventer in Tovar. Here, Otis Graham didn't know about the spread protector on the ground. That's true. But what they did in Tovar was the company man recommended to his superiors with the operating company that they shut down the well. It was the actual recommendation of the company man. He didn't step in and take action himself to shut down the well. Interesting that in this case, Mr. Bros, when asked, and it was just quoted to the court, when asked, is something like this, like leaving thread protectors laying around the ground, the type of carelessness and inattentiveness contemplated in paragraph 6 of the contract? And yes, he says, I guess, but his answer is yes. It is. It is the type of carelessness and inattention that would trigger paragraph 6 of this drilling contract. So if we're really comparing Tovar to this circumstance, I think if anything, and the completion of the sentence was, what I would expect is for the company man to go to the tool pusher and tell him to clean up the area. Well, that is much more pervasive control than sending it up to their superiors and looking for a ruling from the operating company.
Well, the control issue, is it necessary for the defendants to have control over the safety aspect of the work site? And regardless of what control they may have had with regard to other operations, they could not be found liable unless they had some control over the safety of the project.
Your Honor, and I think the court's making reference to its opinion in Exxon versus Tidwell. There, the court articulated the necessary control over safety aspects of the project. The paragraph that we're talking about, paragraph 6, talks about carelessness or inattention. That language in and of itself contemplates oversight over safety. I think the court can look at that language and contemplate that. But even aside from that paragraph, There are admissions in the testimony of Otis Graham with regard to his responsibility for workplace safety. There are admissions with regard to, from Mr. Brose, Clayton Williams, his company representative that testified at trial with regard to his obligations for safety. So if we limit it to safety, and I don't think this court really meant to do that in Exxon versus Tidwell. I think you meant to talk about safety, but I think you also meant to talk about whatever the injury-producing conduct is.
Is it your argument that the independent contractor's duty and the contractor's duty toward the independent contractor's employees is coextensive? In other words, is there any difference in the
duty between
Clayton Williams and the drilling contractor here insofar as Mr. Olivo is concerned, or is it the same?
I think it's a question of what control the operator kept. If the court, let me make sure I understand what the court's asking. You're asking me to compare Clayton Williams' responsibility for safety on the premises in Diamond M.
Well, you said that Clayton Williams had a duty, as evidenced by the contract, to prevent carelessness and inattention.
Yes, sir.
And you said that relates to safety.
Yes.
So can I infer from that accurately that you're saying that the duty was the same? Employer's duty, the drilling contractor, Diamond M, and Clayton Williams' duty toward Mr. Olivo was essentially identical. That is not to be negligent and cause an injury to Mr. Olivo.
I would argue, yes, they are coextensive insofar as control is retained over those aspects of the driller's activities.
As far as injuries on the work site related to unsafe conditions.
Yes, sir. Now, your question calls to mind the difference between Clayton Williams and Otis Graham in this case, and the court's opinion last Friday informs it. The only reason that Otis Graham is in this case is because he's an independent contractor. It's because Clayton Williams took the position he's an independent contractor and has taken that position through its points of error to this court. I don't see that there is any basis to say that insofar as the jury found that he was an employee, the Court of Appeals has not tampered with that ruling, and this court has refused the point of error on that point. I don't see that there's any distinction between him as an employee and him as an employee. I mean, the employees that existed in Hornsby, he is an employee by virtue of what's the history of this case.
Hey, Mr. Bigley, to explore this question from Judge Cornett. Does it make any difference in this case whether the negligence was in the putting the pipe caps on the ground or in leaving them there after they were on the ground? Does it make any difference to you?
Your Honor, there's evidence in the record that Clayton Williams, through his representative, Otis Grant, required that the thread protector be utilized. There's evidence in the record that it was unusual to use thread protector. There's evidence in the record that it being unusual, the appropriate care that an operator should take under those circumstances where they're requiring the equipment is to see that they're used safely. Now that means both in the putting on, if you will, of these thread protectors on the pipe, carrying them up the V-door, taking the thread protector off so that they can then be hoisted.
So do you agree with Mr. Huddleston that there is no evidence that Graham or Williams had actual knowledge that these thread protectors were somehow misplaced on the ground?
There's no evidence in the record that he had actual knowledge with regard to this particular thread protector at this particular time.
Under your view of the case, are Williams and Graham liable because someone was negligent in placing the caps on the ground because they're the ones who required the caps to be used? Is that your view?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that that insofar as they required the thread protectors to be used, they had, under the contract, extensive control over the equipment to be utilized on site. They should have provided a plan. They should have provided a method of storing the thread protectors that were not being used. In this case, the evidence is that this thread protector was being repeatedly used. And hence, it seems more like an activity than a condition, if you will. But therefore, it would have been in the use of the threat protector. That is, instead of, and let me just put it in concrete terms, instead of just screwing it off on the floor of the rig and kicking it down onto the ground, which is what was happening, a prudent operator would have required his driller to take that threat protector, if they're going to require the threat protector, to take that threat protector, unscrew it, carry it down the catwalk, put it onto the next joint of pipe that's going to be rolled, and then roll that pipe. That is my contention, that with regard to the appropriate use of that threat protector, if they were going to be required, they should have assured themselves that it be done correctly.
Assuming the court doesn't agree with you, and I don't know what the court's going to do, but assuming the court doesn't agree with you that there's that pervasiveness of control, that Williams ought to, in fact, be responsible for the conduct of Diamond M's employees for the placement of this, and therefore the court only looks to whatever duty there was to examine the premises for unsafe conditions, and having discovered an unsafe condition to correct it, do you lose on that ground because there was no actual notice to Williams or Graham that these protectors were improperly placed?
Number one is actual or constructive notice under Corbett.
And then what would be your constructive notice?
The constructive notice would be the day before there were casing thread protectors cast about haphazardly on this rig, and so they had constructive notice of the misplacement, if you will, of equipment on the site.
Because Graham was there and saw it?
Graham was there, and not only was there, but he ordered it to be picked up and stacked to one side, Your Honor. I mean, he not only had knowledge of that there was misplacement of equipment from the day before, but actually intervened to try to correct it on that occasion.
To clean up the threat protector.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is a vigilant company man would have been out there inspecting. And indeed, there's testimony from Mr. Graham.
Did you disagree with Mr. I thought I asked you early on if you agreed with Mr. Huddleston's representation that neither Williams nor Graham had actual knowledge these threat protectors were improperly placed. And you just now said that Graham testified he saw them and ordered them to be moved.
The day before, we're talking about casing threat protectors. The day of, we're talking about, and I limited it in my answer to this particular threat protector on this particular occasion. The court is absolutely correct. There was no actual knowledge. But there was actual knowledge of scattered and dangerous threat protectors about the premises from the day before. That is evidence in the record. And indeed, with regard to inspection, this is something I didn't say in my brief, but with regard to inspection, Graham himself testified that he should have been out on the rig more. He had a heart condition that was keeping him in the trailer more. So he himself admits that he should have been out there inspecting more.
Counsel, is it your contention then, based upon your answers to my questions and Judge Enoch's questions, that the contractual provision that says that Williams shall have no direction or control of the contractor or its employees and agents except in the results to be obtained, is it your contention that that is essentially without effect under the circumstances of this case?
Yes, and let me tell you why. And they have placed great emphasis on the independent contractor paragraph 14. Number one, the exact same contract, and I didn't say this in my brief, so I hope I to gather everybody's attention. The exact same provision was in Ensorge versus Parker. This court described it. It said there was a provision in the contract that required them to be independent contractors, and the court nevertheless reversed the summary judgment in favor of defendants in that case, and made the determination that there was sufficient evidence to control that. So, number one, look at your own opinion and answer for the part. Number two, the footnote 3 in Exxon versus Tibble. What this court describes there is that the control that is retained the evidence is to be provided in these circumstances in derogation of these provisions of independent contractor status in the contract. I would venture to guess that all of the court's opinions dealing with Redinger versus Living probably had similar provisions. And I know that may be speculative, but this court has been here. And that the cases I'm talking about, there have been three cases since Redinger versus Living. And indeed, Redinger versus Living, the procedural history is exactly the same. a lower court had previously made a determination as a matter of law that there was no insufficient control so as to establish a 414 duty. In each of those cases, as a matter of law, no duty. And it comes to this court, and in each of those cases, I'm talking about Redinger, Tovar, Pollard versus MOPAC, and Ensorge versus Parker. In each of those four cases, this court reverses and either renders for the plaintiff because there had been a trial, or reverses and holds in favor of the plaintiff remanding for trial, concluding that there was sufficient evidence to establish a 414 duty. And if you compare the facts of control in those cases to the facts of control in this case, there's no question there's a duty in this case. I respectfully submit to this court that there is no way that you can reverse this to Otis Grant based on your Hornsby decision. But you can't, and I don't disagree with the reasoning in Hornsby. I have a problem. I don't think we should be penalized, if you will, because we've kept him in the case, because it has been Clayton Williams' contention throughout that he's an independent contractor. That issue, I think, at this point, the court having denied the point of error, a review on the point of error, is moot. But I don't think this court, respectfully, can reverse in favor of Clayton Williams without overruling Redinger, Tovar, Pollard, and Parker, because the facts of control are much more pervasive in this case compared to those cases. I probably didn't do a very good job of answering Justice Cornyn's addressing Mr. Huddleston's response to Justice Cornyn's question. He talked about paragraph 6 only becoming relevant if the well was in jeopardy, as occurred in Togo. And that, I think, ignores Clayton Williams' representative's own testimony that having threat protectors scattered about is a problem that would fall under the inattentiveness or carelessness provision under paragraph 6. That's what he said. And so he didn't say anything about the well having to be in jeopardy for that provision to become applicable. And so I take issue with Mr. Huddleston's contention that the well has to be in jeopardy for paragraph 6 to become relevant.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Let's say that you own a house that's going to be completely remodeled. Every piece of sheetrock is going to be torn down.
Yes, sir.
And it's going to be built from new. And you enter into a contract with a general contractor. And in that contract, it specifically says that, of course, you, the homeowner, have the total right of control with regard to when they start, when they stop working, different things like that. But, of course, you're expecting the general contractor to be the one who runs the show. And then you have the general contractor hire a subcontractor, and that subcontractor gets hurt on the site. He slips and falls on something that, as you were walking through the house yesterday, you saw that it was there. Would you, the homeowner, be liable for that?
Are you saying that I did not create the condition?
You didn't create it, but you knew it was there. And you had this right of control, right to tell them when to start, when to stop, a few other control issues.
Well, if I have the control so as to be able to tell them to remedy that situation and I did nothing, then yes. I think if the contract is perfectly analogous to what we have here, yes. Now, I think you can probably make some, as the court has, for instance, in dram shop situations, I think the Beard case, make a distinction between an individual who has a home and has a contractor working in his home and Clayton Williams Jr. Incorporated, who has wells and is hiring contractors all the time to drill wells and to do other operations out there. That's my answer. I think that if we look at, again, going back to those four cases, Justice Abbott, you mentioned three categories. Premises liability under, say, 343, Corbin, whatever. A Redinger 414 activity, duty, and then perhaps, can I finish
this? You may finish the three categories.
And then under 414, a responsibility for workplace safety. Each of the cases I talked about if we look at what went on in those cases, is the blowout preventer a defective condition in Tovar? In Parker, a gasket blew out and the workers were asphyxiated. Is that gasket a premises condition or is it an activity? The court didn't make that distinction. What the court said is that they failed to provide a safe workplace. That's the third category. That's what the court has identified. I think it's been previously recognized, and I think it exists in this case.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
The question was asked about the casing thread protectors that had been examined the day prior to Mr. Olivo's injury. And I think that the record at best has been treated liberally in that regard. Mr. Villarreal indicated that casing thread protectors had been cast about haphazardly and that Graham ordered Mr. Olivo to do something with them, and that is simply not the case. I refer the court to pages 125 and 126 of the statement of facts where the question was asked, Mr. Graham never asked you to do anything on that job, did he? The answer was, yes, sir, on that day we were setting casing. He was out there and we were taking the thread protectors off of that casing, and he asked us to make sure we stacked them on the side over there with the people from the casing company when they come to pick up the casing that were left, that they could take them with them. So clearly, this was an opportunity for Mr. Graham to just have the casing thread protectors set aside where they could be retained and could be picked up by the casing company, and I would certainly label this more in the form of a request rather than an order or a directive. Also, in response to a question from Justice Enoch, Mr. Villarreal indicated that the record established that Williams required the use of thread protectors, and that simply was not the case. The record, I believe, clearly establishes the contrary, and that is that Williams did not require the use of thread protectors, and that the decision to use thread protectors was solely that of Johnny Cabala, the tool pusher on the job. With respect to the discussion about so-called admissions by John Rose and others that concerning the interpretation of paragraph 6.1 of the drilling contract, I would point out the paragraph that paragraph 6.1 and its interpretation are questions of law. Mr. Rose was a lay witness and was being asked hypothetical questions regarding paragraph 6.1. And I don't think that testimony should be taken as the gospel regarding what that means. That would be a matter for the court to determine. And in that regard, I would point the court to pages 574 and 575 of the record in which Mr. Brose testified that the responsibility for safety on the job was that of Diamond M and the tool pusher. And finally,
your time is up. Are there any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument. In the first call, the court will now.